But a lot of this is also about the systemic issues that we need to see addressed. That's the money and politics part of our petition. We're going to keep organizing, and we're going to keep pulling in more coworkers. We're amplifying a lot of voices that we've heard already of people very concerned about, not only our employees, the users of our system, and again, how do we even get here and how do we address these systemic issues?
Can you explain, Alejandra, what keyword subpoenas are?
Right. So they've been actually used for a long time. And the whole idea is that basically, because Google knows a lot about what users do on our system, down to they usually know that you made that search, it is possible for law enforcement to use that information to find what people do. In fact, there's an interesting case actually here in Denver where they were able to use a keyword search for somebody looking up a particular address to figure out who went to a house. In this case, what we are very likely to see is requests for keyword searches of, I'm searching for an abortion. Maybe also providing that information in other search results. That we believe that that's very likely going to start to happen more and more as people look to criminalize pregnancy and not just be searching for providers, but actually searching for those who are just seeking it out.
Finally, what will be the response? I mean, more than 650 of you of Alphabet workers have signed this petition. If you don't get a response?
Well, we've been organizing for more than a year and a half, amplifying employee voices. We're going to continue to work on that. We're starting to collaborate with other unions because we believe this needs to be a national response. This is absolutely a labor issue. It's an impact to our healthcare rights, and we must protect those. And we're going to continue to bring more people on to figure out what do we do about this? How can we listen to the employees who know a lot about these systems, who know where the information is and what's really the right way to fix these problems. And I will put out a call to all fellow employees, join us. This is the time. This is when we need you. Don't wait.
On that note, Alejandra Beatty, I want to thank you for being with us, Southwest Chapter Lead with the Alphabet Workers Union, speaking to us from Denver. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
The Montevilla Jazz Festival, now in its ninth year, happens Friday, August 19th through Sunday, August 21st. Montevilla Jazz supports community building and enriches local culture by showcasing original music made right here in Portland. More festival information can be found at montevillajazz.org.
You are listening to Moccasin Tracks. My name is Deb Rigger, and Moccasin Tracks is being broadcast from the traditional ancestral homeland of the Western Abenaki people who have lived in this area for more than 12,000 years. It is known as Ndakina, the land of the people of the dawn, also known as New Hampshire. We acknowledge and honor the people who still have a spiritual and cultural connection to this land. And thank you for tuning in today. I want to introduce you to Rick Hunt, who is co-host.
Hi there. Welcome to Moccasin Tracks. Hunt at Moccasin Tracks. We're going to be playing a song called Community Radio. That's kind of fun. Today, our guest will be Rhonda Besaw, who is Canadian Mete and Abenaki. And she is a traditional bead worker. Amazing work. Her work is in all kinds of museums and just fabulous, incredible work. So she will be with us, and we'll be interviewing her. So thank you for tuning in. And again, we're Moccasin Tracks. And have a wonderful Tuesday.
girl, she makes me smile. She likes to twist my dials. She doesn't have an axe to grind. She drives me crazy though, with community radio. I think it rearranged my mind. I'm not so stodgy as I used to be before. I hadn't learned new things since I was 24. Now we listen both together. Music, news, life, art, and weather. Hear it all on community radio. My friend works for Network Hacks. He's spreading corporate facts. He tries to keep me scared all day. He wants me in my house, too scared to move my mouth, 'cause he don't know what I might say. He tries to make me feel so helpless once again, so he can Facebook stalk me with his robot friend. Now he only finds that I don't have the time, because I'm listening to community radio. Happiness feels. I remember what's really real, to connect with people evermore. And I know what causes fail, to put our hearts on sale, to look for joy inside a store. Try to broadcast what I know, because I dare. Maybe I'm real confused, or maybe there's something there. It's your time, it's your choice. Spin the dial, hear my voice. Hear it all on community radio. Community radio. Hear it now, hear it first. We can sing, we're diverse, and we're all on community radio. Well, first of all, hear it straight. Even Ursula thinks it's great. Hear it all on community radio.
And we are getting ready right now to interview the amazing bead worker, Rhonda Besaw. And if I may, I would like to tell you a little bit about her creative philosophy. Rhonda is Canadian Mete and Abenaki, and she writes on her website, Wabanaki Beadwork, "My ancestors have lived in southern Quebec, Canada, and on both sides of the Quinnetec, Connecticut River in New Hampshire and Vermont for hundreds of years. By doing beadwork in the same style and manner as my ancestors, I honor those who have gone before me and give to those in the future. Through beadwork, the reality of Abenaki survival can be shared and acknowledged. Through beadwork, perhaps my brothers and sisters, my relatives, will recognize a piece of who they are and who they were. Perhaps some will be inspired to learn more about their culture. Perhaps others will be inspired to pick up a needle and thread and tell their own story of survival. To me, beadwork is breathing. It is that natural and essential. Just as breathing keeps the physical body alive, beadwork keeps my spirit alive. Beadwork designs that are influenced by the world around me, such as mountains or medicine plants, keep me observant, grounded, and grateful to Mother Earth. Designs received from the dream world and visions are a most treasured gift. I marvel at waking up in the morning with a beadwork design fully developed in my mind. The colors, the patterns, the symbols, and the meaning, it's all there. Every stitch becomes a prayer of thanksgiving to my ancestors and the Creator. My needle just flies when making such a project. These designs are the most powerful, the physical manifestations of spirit captured in bits of glass and cloth. And I give you Rhonda Besaw. Welcome, Rhonda. It's an honor to have you.
Welcome to Moccasin Tracks, Rhonda Besaw.
Hi, Deb Rieger. Okay, I am speaking to you from Whitefield, New Hampshire.
When you do your work, you're usually at home, unless you're out teaching at a museum or other places where you are often teaching and exhibiting, and so we really appreciate taking the time to, you know, tell our radio listeners a little bit about your work. What would be a typical day for you getting started in a beadwork project?
If I'm starting a beadwork project, I have drawn it out, usually drawn the design out on paper ahead of time.
I like that you told us that that you sketch it out and you have using sometimes graph paper, and those ideas that sometimes come to you in dreams and are offered through spirit. It's such a beautiful statement that you have on your website, which is rhondabesaw.com. And, you know, just to make this a little short but yet interesting for our listeners, could you just share a story about what inspired you to first get started doing beadwork?
Well, that's kind of funny. Many years ago, about 25 years ago, some of the folks in Littleton might remember Terry Clothy, who had the store A Different Path. And I used to go to Terry's store, and Terry was very much encouraging me to take up basket making. So we used to travel out to see Newt Washburn in Bethlehem, and he was showing me how to pound ash and split the rings of the tree to make baskets, and it was all very much hard work. And I remember thinking, I don't think basket making's for me. This is very difficult. So Terry and Newt were a little disappointed, but I used to continue to go out there and visit. And soon after that, I was watching Jim Clothy do beadwork. And what was interesting about Jim was he only had one hand, half an arm on the other side, and he was beating. And I was so impressed by that. I thought, if he can do it, I can do it. So Terry showed me a beadworking stitch that was very simple, and I still do that same stitch today.
Wow. That's so cool. And I know you have also inspired many others to, with those first simple stitches. And on your website, you have a couple projects that people can actually do with you. But one of the areas that I wanted to ask you about was your beaded purses. And they're just so magnificent. And you talk about some of the designs coming from dreams and that guidance that sometimes is conscious, but also is guided by spirit. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, Rhonda, and how when you dream a design, what happens?
Well, it just happens. I have to say it just must be spirit. 'Cause at times I have gotten up in the morning and the design is all there. The meaning of the design, the colors of the beads, everything is there. And my understanding is if we don't honor the dream by making the thing, then those dreams will no longer come to us. So if I am fortunate enough to get a design from a dream, then I will bead it right away. But the purses, the latest couple have been from simply going outside and seeing what's growing there in nature. Because so much inspiration can come just from the medicine plants and the flowers and the trees that are on my property.
Oh, that's beautiful. If there was something that you would want our listeners to take away from this conversation, you know, you are deeply rooted in your Abenaki ways and spiritual connections, traditional Abenaki, I don't want to say the word art because there's not the word art in the language, but the beauty that people make with their hands and that it lives through you. I feel like it lives through you because we see so many beautiful examples when we go to your website and see the pictures. What could you tell our listeners that is something that they could think about as not just, you're not just history, you are like living today but practicing maybe some of those things that are talked about in history books. And how is that? And, you know, how can we appreciate that more in recognizing your art and, you know, seeing your art?
I think what I do is a continual flow from all my ancestors. And I don't copy old designs. Like there's thousands of beaded purses out there that the Wabanaki people did. I don't copy those designs, but I study those designs. And so I have an idea of the flavor of the designs. And then I try to bring it forward into something contemporary today, because we're not a stagnant society, and I don't do copies of the old stuff. So I try to make these designs new.
That's so cool. Do you feel like you're still, you know, learning about beading, and do you feel like there's always something new to try?
The more I know, the more I realize I don't know. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. Rick, while we have Rhonda here, is there anything that you would, as an artist, want to ask her about? And want to give us your, turn on your mic, and you can ask her a question.
Hello. Nice to see you. Welcome.
I'm glad to see you, too.
Thank you. I have always admired your work. It is incredible. And as we know, it's in lots of museums, and it's been all over the place. It's just incredible what you do. You made me a pair of moccasins about 25 years ago, which I still have. And of course, my son Josh wore them for years as a traditional dancer. And then when he went to Boston to become Italian, he left them with me again. So they're beautiful. And we've seen your work at the Abbey Museum in Bar Harbor, Maine. Your bags are just wonderful. Are you doing any more of the women's series, like you had done Grandmother Molly and Marge Bruchac and a few others? Are you still working on that?
It's kind of sort of in the back of my mind, but those beaded portraits are very time consuming. Mm. I think there was 15,000 beads, and they have to be set up on a very large loom.
Wow.
So I have to devote like 6 months to do one of those portraits, and I kind of moved on. I just got...
Wow.
Uh-oh. I think I lost you.
No, we still have you. We still have you. I think you're working.
I must be on the computer then.
Yep, you're on the computer.
How'd I do that?
I don't know how you did it, but whatever it's set at right now, it's working.
Oh, my. Hey, maybe it's the spirits.
Yeah, they're helping us out. Helping us out a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I know the technology is a challenge, and kind of, you know, it puts us all off balance a little bit, but Rhonda, your work is just so beautiful, and you know, there was something that struck me when I was like looking at your website last night, and it was that odd bead that sometimes, you know, it's something different that gets put into, you know, like a row of, say, blue beads or something, and then all of a sudden there's this odd bead. And I was wondering, can you speak to that a little bit? Because it seemed that that really is important to you, and it's important to the piece. What does it mean?
I've heard people speak about that. They call it a spirit bead, that it's to remind us that we are imperfect, only spirit is perfect. So some people will intentionally put a different colored bead in their beadwork to represent that, but I have honestly found I've never had to intentionally do it. It just happens by itself.
Oh, wow.
when I was beading when I was younger, I would look at that and think, oh, I made a mistake. I need to go back and take that out. But as time went on, I just said, nope, they're staying. For whatever reason, they're there. And sometimes people notice if they have a really sharp eye, but most of the time, people don't even notice where that is. So I just let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so cool. It's a beautiful, it's kind of a lesson, a little bit of humility, a little bit of just, you know, welcoming those spirits or whatever to be part of your project in a good way, you know. So it's beautiful. We wanted to also talk about wool coats, and I was reading in a book about Native New Yorkers by Evan Pritchard, and he was quoting a treaty that was happening, and I believe it was like the mid-1700s, and one of the items in the treaty was wool coats, and I was wondering, in your research and that you do, what can you tell us, when would wool coats been part of a trading item?
Yeah, I do have a cool story about wool coats. I think it's cool. These would have been traded through the centuries, like we're talking 1700s, 1800s, where Native people and Europeans exchanged clothing, you know, part of the trade. But what I think is really cool is a man would get one of those military style coats, an Indian man. A bead worker would take that coat and just bead it. And sometimes the coat would be handed down from generation of bead worker to the next generation of bead worker, to the next generation of bead worker, because they were so heavily beaded. So when the Indian man would be seen by the Europeans wearing this beautifully beaded coat, the Europeans would look at that Indian man and say, oh, he must be the chief. Look at that coat. He must be so important. He must be somebody. So that is the person that the Europeans would deal with. But the truth of the matter is that man had an extraordinary bead worker behind him. So I think that's really cool. And when I was really researching these coats, I connected with the Museum of Victoria in Melbourne, Australia, who had the coat that I really wanted to research. They sent me CDs showing the coat inside and out, the history of the coat. And that's where I got inspired to try and make a coat. But that's when I found out too, the amount of beadwork on those coats could not be accomplished in one generation.
Wow. Yeah.
So yeah. They have to go to the younger generation to continue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. Wow. Imagine that. That kind of heirloom being handed down. Yeah.
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 You also talk a little bit about collars and cuffs on your website, and is this something that you encourage beaters to, you know, work on?
I encourage beaters to work on everything. You know, when I started with my own regalia because that was closest to me. It's taken me all these years to get to the point of doing collar and cuffs because there's nothing, there's not much out there for information. So you got to do your research. And the collars that I'm doing are my own design, but that comes from studying many of the old collars. Again, I'm not copying an old collar. I'm making it uniquely mine with incorporating old double curve designs.
Yeah, yeah. That's so.
And my plan is to put some collar patterns on my website that people can download for free. I've done that with the peaked caps. the hoods that I make. I have free instructions, free patterns available on my website. I've been very pleased that people from all over the United States and Canada have downloaded those instructions for peaked caps and the patterns, and they have made many, many peaked caps. It's been very gratifying. So
beautiful. Yeah.
I'm going to move on to collars and put that out there to encourage people to start making these collars.
Oh, that's so beautiful. So I want to thank you for tuning in today. We're talking to bead worker Abenaki Matee from Canada, Abenaki, who's living now in New Hampshire. And we're so honored to have her on the air with us today, Rhonda Besaw. We want to hear more of your story. We're so, it's so interesting. It's not enough to just have you on for these few minutes. And Rick, is there anything else in closing that you want to add?
I just want to add thank you, Rhonda, for coming onto the show today. It's a real pleasure to have you on here, and it's an honor. Thank you.
Yeah. And a couple minutes in closing, Rhonda, if you'd like to say anything in closing to our listeners.
Well, for Rick, if those moccasins need resoling by now, let me know.
Aw, thank you. Thank you.
just a couple things that I'd like to say. There's a quote that I just love by a Penobscot woman. If you've heard the book Penobscot in Paris by Bunny McBride, It's the story of Molly Dellis Nelson, Molly Spotted Elk.
Okay.
And Molly Spotted Elk said, "The beautiful things live and heal the wounds of sorrow."
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, that
so,
is.
Through all kinds of challenging times, beadwork for me has been medicine and a solace to the spirit. And the other thing I'd like to say, in all this time of ugly, the things we see on the news and the terrible, terrible things that happen, we can choose to make beauty. So make beautiful is what I would say to people, no matter what form, whether it's song, beadwork, artwork, whatever. Make beauty.
Oh, thank you so much. It's just been an honor to talk to you today, and I'm sure we'll do it again soon.
Okay.
You be
thank
well.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
Waiting for some wings, take me up to bigger things. I've been waiting for some time to close my eyes and free my mind, and I'll be waiting for my wings tonight. Take the light.
talking to the bears. They told me courage is stronger than fear, and I'll be waiting for my wings tonight. Just close my eyes and free my mind. I'm not afraid to take the flight.
The state of Vermont, by proclamation of the governor, declared the first week of May Abenaki Heritage Week. In the following recording by Moccasin Tracks, three Abenaki women, Carol Irons, Carol McGranahan, and Andrea Brett, presented at the Lost Nation Theater in Montpelier, Vermont. Thank you to Kim Bent, founder and director, for facilitating this panel discussion. The complete presentation can be found on the YouTube page for Moccasin Tracks. Thank you for listening.
What are the traditional roles, so to speak, of women versus men in the Abenaki culture?
They're only deferring to me because I'm older. It's a sign of respect, but it's also a cop-out. There were gender roles, for sure, and women are the life bringers. It was not at all the kind of attitude toward women that came across the Great Water with the settlers. Women certainly were not chattel property, which they were with the settlers. So there was a huge cultural contrast right off. But the women, obviously, are the life bringers, the ones that bring new life into the world and among the people. The women are seen as an extension of Mother Earth, who also is a life bringer. And the women are the nurturers and, to a great extent, the teachers. So it's a very honored role. They were certainly totally equal with the men. It was pretty much an egalitarian culture. Women could do virtually anything as girls and young women, but they were taught the kinds of skills that a woman in a community as a homekeeper and a caretaker of children would need to know. In other words, how to make clothing, how to preserve food, cooking, things like that. But also they could go out on the trails. There were women who were traders. There were women who took the warrior trail until they started childbearing. At that point in time, because their role was so terribly important for the future of the people, because the children were the future of the culture of the people, then they tended to stay much closer to camp and to the group and take care of the children. So you will hear sometimes there's not much in recorded history, because that wasn't recorded by us, that was recorded by other people who only saw things through their cultural lens and misunderstood some things. But you will occasionally hear of women chiefs. There were women who were medicine persons as well as men. There were women who went out on raids until they reached the point where they started childbearing. So it had everything to do with the role of nurturer and the keeper of the future of the people with the life bringing.
I go with that. Carol has so much historical knowledge, and for me to look at an elder as as Carol is, that was another role that was very, very important to the people. That an elder was considered to be so because they knew. And the people who came to them for advice and knowledge knew that what they were being taught was real. It's a little bit sad nowadays that women and the elders don't have the kind of respect that the culture traditionally had. But I think that maybe we can bring that back as people become aware, more aware of the importance and the value that women have as culture bearers and as teachers. They're nurturers. They're all that Carol mentioned. So for me, it's very important to go back to the old ways, to learn what the old ways were. And the best resource for that are the elders and the women, the culture bearers.
And again, growing up, the women were the storytellers, again, with that culture, being culture bearers, with the storytelling and passing that along to the community, to the children, many, many times, literally sitting at the knee of my mother and other women elders in the community and hearing the stories passed on. And some of the kids would be like, oh, you told that story already, and they'd want to go run off and play. And yet they still told it again, and they told it again, and they told it again, so that we hopefully would remember and be able to carry that forward. And women during healing circles, would sit in the East in honor of being the ones who bring the life into the world. It wasn't a relegation. It was an acknowledgement of that role, and women wearing skirts, and especially if you were still having periods, let's be frank about it, that was expected. And it was not the way European culture came into this country to and treated women. It was a recognition of honor of our role and what and women being exactly that. So I agree with what Carol has said and those that additional information for you.
We're fighting with the men, mostly. Too many of our men are very, as we call it, they're very colonized. They have adopted an awful lot without, I think, real awareness, that they've adopted a lot of the value system of the dominant society. And the women who are traditionalists have pulled back into the shadows literally for decades, for the past 100 years or more. And they're beginning to do that again because the men are, especially now that it's safe to be Native American, the men are quite taken, but and a few women, but mostly it's the men, with how can I make money off this culture, because there's a big interest in it. And it's something that's deeply troubling to some of us women, at least, because it's exploiting the culture for money, and that's not an old Abenaki value. We didn't commercialize our culture and our teachings, and some of our teachings are really sacred. We don't run around doing a pipe ceremony every time there's a few people gathered as a way of kind of being on display. That's an abuse of a sacred ceremony. Yep. Without the participants really having had proper teachings or understanding. So how do we bring that back? The women are working together more and more and discussing these things and teaching each other, because we're having to relearn. We lost a lot. We spent a lot of time hiding in plain sight. If you met me on the street, you wouldn't necessarily know that I'm Native American. And we had to do that because there was a lot of discrimination, but there also, in the early part of the 20th century, there was a very active effort to get rid of us. I mean, first there were the wars. Most of the wars were really between French and British, and then British and colonists. They weren't really our wars, but our warriors got right into it as auxiliaries because they could be warriors. But also they thought if they could help one side or another win, maybe it could help all our people because those who were more abusive could maybe be conquered and got rid of. It didn't really work, but it was tried. So now it's safe to be Abenaki. The state is not trying to sterilize our people, or take most of the time, not trying to take the children away, put them in foster homes, which is what happened in Vermont. But now that it's safe, there are too many of people who are thinking, okay, now there's a lot of people interested. I can do presentations and make a lot of money. And so the women are having to struggle with this because we keep trying to talk with the men. Wait a minute, that's not helping our people. We do these presentations because we want to share understandings with well-intentioned people who are interested and respectful and want to learn. And we have no problem with that. We're willing to share. We're very willing to dialogue. We just ask that it be treated with respect. And we are trying to teach our own women, and then by extension, the children and the men and the families, to bring back those teachings, which much of which got lost.
Andrea, did you have a comment?
There's also the environment of power. And so, right or wrong, good or bad, if there's a piece of steak and there's four of you, you're going to fight over who gets the piece of steak and who gets the biggest piece. And instead of acknowledging that we need to, I feel that we are moving into the realm of being the elder women in the community as part of answering your question. And so many of our female elders have passed on. So we don't have them for ourselves anymore. We've lost that. And if within that wanting to grab power, hold power, if the male leaders of our communities would hold the respect for the female elders, it is our job to not only say to them, wait, you're supposed to be treading lightly here, and you need to be humble. You don't have this, the European mindset of this power because you deserve it. You have this power because, and it is a responsibility, it is a gift, and you need to be responsible with that. One needs to. So that's another thing that in Abenaki, the you, the way it is used plurally. So that, just to back up that statement for you. So really, as Carol said, as we becoming the elder women of the community, we need to find a way to remind the male leaders of our community that this is our job and this is our role and this is our responsibility. I don't know the best answer for you. We don't have one. I would like to, that's my utopian thinking. And we also have a community of a very dear coworker of mine said, hurt people, hurt people. And we ourselves need to engage in our own communal healing and then have a chance to bring that to the not only our own children within the Abenaki community. And hopefully that model is of value to bring to others in the wider community. That's my pie in the sky thinking on that. You can tell I've thought a lot about it.
Thank you. I think it's important to note, well, Carol, did you wanted to go ahead?
Yeah, I think one thing that we can all do to bring this change about is to listen more to the women. But the women, on the other hand, have to grow a voice. And a lot of us have been in the background for so long that we either don't dare speak out, or when we do, we feel so uncomfortable that we don't say what we really feel. It's hard to grow a voice. I probably was the least vocal person you've ever met until having the experience on the Native American Commission that, you know, you have to go out, you have to be strong, you have to advocate for your people. And to do that, you can't hide in the shadows, you have to come forth. And as uncomfortable as it is, that's really how change takes place. So I think the media takes the easy way out, that they often only communicate with those who are quite visible and don't look beyond that and look to a lower level of, you know, we're always in the background, we're always there, we're always teaching, and we do have a voice, we're just not quite as vocal. So I think that that's one of the big changes. And I see a little bit, as Carol said, women are teaching each other, and they're giving each other that confidence to go out and speak and take that chance that people may not listen, but on the other hand, even if you reach one person, that much of the world has changed.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, I'm sad and happy at the same time that I only have one meeting left. I've been on the commission for 6 years now, and four of those have been as chair. I have to say that without my vice chair, Carol, I never could have accomplished what we have with the commission. We talked through a lot of stuff, but this year, for example, we were working on the school mascot band that we did not feel that ethnic school mascots were appropriate and were very harmful. That legislation was passed. The land tax exempt bill for Abenaki-owned land, that passed. We, over the years, have gotten Indigenous Peoples Day, as it's changed from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. We've had proclamations for Abenaki Heritage Week. Signage for the state parks in Abenaki, those were added, and as the signs are changed, the Abenaki language will be added. Oh gosh, there's more. There's more, but.
Well, they now, because the legislature began learning, because of Carol's advocacy with the Friends of the State House Diversity Committee, and she worked for almost a year and a half to get the Abenaki display in the State House. I had her back, but she was the one advocating, and at one point she began explaining to them the story of her family during the eugenics, and I was thinking, oh gosh, we don't talk about that stuff. And I was ducking my head, and she kept right on, of course. And then I looked around, and everybody at the table, and there was 12 to 15 people at the table, they were all leaning over, looking intently, listening totally. There was dead silence in the room except Carol telling this story, which put a face and some flesh on something that had happened early in the 20th century that most of them had no idea about because it's not taught in the public schools. Part of our effort to write and do presentations now is because this kind of knowledge needs to get out, and now you all are gonna, you know, carry a little bit more knowledge and understanding with you, hopefully. And we're trying to get material that can go to the schools, like the coloring, the book with language vocabulary that came out of the Missisquoi tribe, and the booklet I wrote summarizing from an indigenous point of view about the history. But as Carol sat there telling this, the legislator, there was only one legislator in the room, but the friends of the State House were stunned. This was totally new information to them. Now they weren't, most of them weren't as old as I am, but still, they'd come up in the public schools mid-20th century, two-thirds of the way through 20th century, and this had never been taught. That leaked on out and got into the legislature, and the legislature this past year did, and you'll hear from the legislator who headed that effort up, he really did his homework, legislator Representative Tom Stevens. He did his homework. He really had studied it, and he led the legislative effort for them to issue a formal apology by joint session of both the representatives and the Senate. Picking up from that, they wanted to set up a truth and reconciliation process. You heard about the one probably that was done in South Africa with Reverend Desmond Tutu and people there because of apartheid. There was one done up in Maine, which was a real dud. It didn't work well. It was top down and it just didn't work well. They want to do one here in Vermont. And we've tried to work for the last year and a half, trying to, being the women, Abenaki women, trying to push about how that process might best be meeting the needs of the Abenaki people. Unfortunately, the dominant society's values, and they control the legislative process, and they know what's best for us, I guess. And there are other groups that have also been struggling with the same issue now, once this all kind of broke open, that we had been, our people had been sterilized or discriminated against. Certainly black people had, certainly people with disabilities have experienced that, and so on. There's minority groups in Vermont. They're struggling with how to do this, and we have tried very hard to have input into that. But that's us trying to have input into the dominant society with their own assumptions and understandings and their own structure of how things happen in this state. We don't control that structure. And having input into it is, well, I could use a crude phrase, I won't, but it's difficult. So that's part of what we've really been working in. It's part of the reason I'm very glad I've got one more meeting, because it's frustrating. But there are good people who are trying to address this. It's just that they can't think outside of what they've spent 50 years thinking and perceiving, and how they understand things, and how the process works, how the systems work. And for them to somehow step out of that is extremely difficult for them.
I feel also that part of the frustration this year, the commission came up with a list of 7 things on our wish list, and we got 1. So that's part of the frustration too, is that the dominant society doesn't realize, oh my gosh, when they did the land tax exemption, I listened to some of the testimony that the committee was having for funding that, and one lady was like, oh my gosh, it's gonna cost the state $9,000 if we, you know. And they're looking at what, a budget of $800 million or something, you know. And then they finally pass it, but they put all of these guardrails on it, like, well, the assumption is that the Abenaki aren't going to get any more land, I don't know, it was just incredible to know that tax exemptions on churches, schools, animal shelters, cemeteries, VFWs, every alphabet you can think of, And yet the Abenaki were held to this, oh my gosh, you can't ever have any more land. And yet if a church or VFW want to build another facility, no holes barred. And then you look at the bottom line of $9,000 in such a large budget, and they were arguing over that. It really, it's to me kind of a blatant way of showing, of illustrating where the Abenaki stand in this state. You know, it's, if you can give a pet shelter more, I don't know, more credibility or whatever than a group of marginalized people, what does this say? You know, so I think that's part of the advocacy that the commission needs to continue pushing, that we are a people who have been so marginalized over centuries now, that we need to start having more of a voice and more of a recognition that we exist. That's why that display in the State House is so darn important, because people who visit from out of state, I think all the visitors, there's like 150,000 a year who pass through, and they see that display and they go, oh wow, we thought Vermont didn't have any Indians. I mean, that's what we were taught, right? To change that narrative, to make people aware that we are here, we've always been here, is so important, because that's the first step, is recognizing and acknowledging that we're here. When we were doing the workshop with